Hello and welcome to the show. We have a fun one for you this evening, and I guarantee you, you're going to be entertained. We have a great guest, Dean Aliotto. I met him when I was out in Phoenix. He was at the round table, the round robin we did out there in Phoenix, and just I hit it off with him. He's a great guy. He's funny and has a real interesting story to tell. He's going to be on the show. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news. And good news, last week for those people on YouTube, I was able to edit, of course, for the podcast, but for the people on YouTube, we had some major internet issues. I had the cable person over here this week. They spent 2 hours and ended up being just a new router, and the router wasn't even that old. But I think we're going to be good to go, and hopefully that will not happen again. So if you support the show, I want to thank you so much. Anyone can help out. And all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com, and the information's right there. For $2 or more a month, you can help us out. We're always live. You can check us out on YouTube. And we're live at 8 to 10 Eastern Time on either Podcast UFO or on YouTube. We're also on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Thursday night from 10 to midnight. And I guess that's it. Again, I want to thank you if you help us out. And we're ready to get going. Alejandro, how are you? Welcome back.
I am good. How are you?
Doing great. Doing great. Good to see you.
Good. Good to see you, too. I don't dress up. I hope you don't mind. You haven't complained so far. Not that you dress up, really. I'm in my gym outfit. I'll probably go work out. Unlike Dean, I can see Dean already, and he's looking pretty good there. Yeah, I think he did dress up. He's got his hair all... you know, fancy there and looking real good.
Yeah. Dean's in the wings. Our guests are a little behind the scene. Our guests are always in the wings waiting until I bring them on. So what else is happening out there?
Yep. I've got my camera to the green room. Yes. So a lot is happening. This is kind of fun. This is something cool. So I was in Boise with Mark D'Antonio and Ben Hansen this past weekend. And there's this big music festival called Tree Fort there. And they're kind of doing like South by Southwest, where they're adding different festival type things around. So Food Fort, AO Fort, Yoga Fort, and there was Hack Fort. Hack Fort was the tech section. And so I spoke on writing tech, and then we also had a UFO panel there at Hack Fort. The reason I bring it up is a couple reasons. One, it was standing room only. It was packed, which was really cool, because my tech panel probably had half, three-fourths of the room full. But not only were the chairs full, it was standing room, people standing on the chairs or sitting on the tables, and we were just surrounded. So it was a lot of fun, and it was kind of cool because this conference or this event kind of is for the 20-somethings and the hipsters and stuff like this. Not the type we necessarily see at the conference besides Dean. And so it was cool to be able to get to that group and to see that they're really interested in this topic. And I think, you know, one of the great parts is it was a panel, and it was a very interactive panel. And I think that's the sort of thing, you know, they like Comic-Con is all panels. So you get to interact some more. And it was just really cool. So I just wanted to bring that up. Mark and Ben were awesome. You can see, actually, we did a podcast and Mark live streamed it on his Facebook. You can see. But you might remember, I brought this up last week, this article by NY Mag, New York Magazine, and NY Mag for short. And it turns out that one of my buddies who was on the panel with me for tech writing was one of the authors of that story. He, I guess, wrote just a part on the astro, kind of the astrobiology, the planets that we're finding out there. There were other parts about UFOs and ETs, and essentially the article was titled something like Why We Should Believe, Reasons to Believe, 13 Reasons to Believe Aliens Are Real. Do you remember talking about that?
Let's see. I think I read the article. I breezed through it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's a great one.
Mm-hmm. They referred to the New York Times article, of course, with the DOD report and everything. And Leslie didn't like the way they covered that because she mentioned, we never said anything about aliens, which didn't. And I think it's part of this learning curve that's going on. When you talk UFOs, a lot of people in the mainstream media go straight to aliens. But that's not what UFOs are all about, really. That's a portion. But these things are unidentified. And I think that's a message that we keep having to hit home with these people. Unidentified. Otherwise.
Mm-hmm. She's very careful about that. And, you know, and it makes sense. You have to be careful. And it's funny, I know you had Stan Friedman on your show, and you're going to have him on a few more times. But last time I talked to him, he said, you know, don't be so afraid to say it, that some, you know how he does that, some UFO or flying saucers may have aliens in them, you know, that type of thing. But he's saying, don't be so careful, and maybe as you, but I understand.
See, I kind of don't totally agree with him, but of course I'm not 100% convinced like he is that I mean there's a multitude of answers, and I think it's just as important for the alien people to think, you know, to keep their minds open to the possibility of other dimensions, like Michio Kaku has even been talking about in relation to this story recently, the possibility, like you had you know, I guess on that, people from the future. Or when it comes to science, especially space science, usually the answers are something we never could have imagined. Right. You know, they never knew that dark matter existed. They didn't believe anything like that could have existed. These rogue planets that aren't around a star that are just hanging out there in space, they never thought that could exist. So we always find things that we never thought could have. So the answer could be something we can't even conceive of yet. So
that's right.
I think we all have to keep an open mind, and I'll have to remind Mr. Friedman of that.
Yeah, no, I've said that a number of times, and I agree with you that, you know, maybe something we can't even imagine is what is going on. And I think that kind of goes along with what Jacques Vallée has been saying for many years, too, or similar to what he's saying.
What if in an alternate dimension you are like the head of some space program or something?
Finally.
Or maybe your kid in the future, your grandchild or your ancestor is coming back because they're in charge of the world and they want to see, you know, Grandpa Martin. You never know.
Yeah.
You never know what might be going
on. Good advice not to do certain things. I could use that sometimes.
But speaking of UFOs, one real big story that is getting bigger and bigger. It kind of grew slowly about 2 or 3 days ago, maybe a little longer. There was this story about these pilots who had a UFO sighting. The story first came out on the drive.com's Warzone page, and then and it was this FAA audio of these American airline and other planes talking about a UFO sighting. The Phoenix New Times, because this was allegedly over Arizona, the Phoenix New Times, a local paper similar to the Syracuse New Times that Cheryl Costa writes for, they followed up and confirmed with the FAA that that was a legitimate audio, and the FAA gave them a fresh copy of the audio and essentially said, we don't know what it was. And it's a very cool recording. So it happened on February 24th. It was at 3:30 p.m. where an aircraft, a Learjet from the Phoenix Air Group, this is a chartered plane. They do cargo, but they also fly corporate people around and stuff like that. But they're in a Learjet at 37,000 feet. And they asked, was someone supposed to pass us 30 seconds ago? And the control tower said, no, we don't see anything. And they said, yeah, we saw something, definitely saw something over us. It was had a big reflection, and we don't know what it is. I think even right then, someone said UFO, and they all kind of chuckled. A few seconds later, an American Airlines Airbus called in the same thing above them as well. Yeah. They estimated it was maybe 10,000 feet above them, and they were like, is there anything else supposed to be up there? And they said no. The tower out of, I think it was Albuquerque, which was nearby, called again and said, hey, you know, what was that you saw? Could it possibly be a balloon? And they said, no, it's not a balloon. Not sure if it was moving, but it was something. And again, someone just blurts out UFO, and they all kind of laugh. But yeah, they were all kind of baffled as to what was seen. But I think what's most interesting is in this post, you know, Pentagon UFO study world, the media is treating this very seriously. So it's been in a lot of news outlets. It was on ABC. It was on CBS. CBS kind of talked about that and the DOD, and they interviewed Richard Dolan about UFOs. But they're all taking it seriously, and it seems that these pilots and the FAA were very comfortable about sharing this information under the auspices of it being a UFO, an unidentified object. So
yeah,
it just kind of seems that maybe a lot of this, you know, taboo kind of giggle factor has gone away, and people feel more comfortable sharing this sort of information.
I was hoping that would happen, and I do agree. You know, and I think there's always going to be nervous laughter. You know, if someone sees something that either scares them or it's hard to explain or whatever, you know, I don't think that'll ever go away, that someone's going to laugh nervously.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a common, you know, way of dealing with the unknown, especially something that makes you uncomfortable, is laughing about it. But eventually that laughter moves to kind of an acceptance. And it just feels like we're moving closer and closer to that acceptance. Of course, the skeptics are still out there, but at least they're discussing it because, again, these are unidentified. The skeptics can say it could be this or it could be that. And we can research it and figure it out and see if they're right. And sometimes they are. Like with CEFA, the Chilean organization, in a UFO case they had recently, which, you know, some debunkers figured out what it was, I think, definitively. And yeah. So that happens. I think you had the guy who figured it out on your podcast.
Yeah, Mick West, that's who it is, from mm-hmm. Metabunk. He actually was trying to debunk the, you know, the Raytheon, the gimbal video, but mm-hmm. He did not actually make any really good points on that at all, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And a few other people looked at it too and said, well, what about this? What about that? You know, I mean, he just wasn't mm-hmm. hitting all the points. And he was just referring back to the Chilean, you know, UFO. That one in particular, that jet was something like 50 or 75 miles away when these images that were released. That's totally different. They're mm-hmm. you know, maybe less than a mile, I would guess. I don't know. I'm guessing at that.
Well, and the hard part is, without documentation with these videos, we don't know the full extent of the investigation. We hear anecdotally from, like, Leslie and from Luis Elizondo that they were scrutinized by several departments. And unfortunately, much of that documentation is most likely classified and may not ever become declassified. At least that's our job now, to get it declassified. Leslie alluded to at least one document she's got that could help, and hopefully that will be released soon. But there was a whole investigation that went on. Of course, a whole investigation went on with CEFA-A in Chile, and they got it wrong. But as is usually the case, you know, the Americans have a lot more resources to put towards things, and I think they're going to be a lot more careful to call something unidentified. And in this case, you know, with these three videos now, they were not able to identify these. But, you know, Mark D'Antonio, the MUFON, you know, photo and video analyst, has been out there, and he's been kind of not necessarily poo-pooing the videos, but saying, you know, with what we have, the few seconds of each of these videos, it could still be this, this, or that. But he admits he doesn't have the rest of the investigation or more video to determine for sure what they are. And Chris Mellon and others have admitted these videos are very short. They on themselves are not substantial evidence. They are just parts of the investigation that they could release. So hopefully we'll find out more. It's very likely we won't find out a whole lot more. But yeah, it's still a remarkable incident when, you know, the DOD, who is an authority, is saying that these are unknown, and it looks like the media is taking their word for it. And even the FAA, one of the groups that has been most close to the whole idea about UFOs, is now releasing information and saying, hey, yeah, this is an unknown. Here's the information we have about it.
I think that'll be absolutely great if the FAA actually pays attention to this, and there's no shame to it. I don't know what other word to use, but, you know, I mean, like, for instance, the O'Hare sighting, if that happened now, you know, I think it would be taken totally seriously and not,
yeah,
like, tucked away like it was.
You know, Tucker Carlson on Fox News, he was really they were talking a lot about the O'Hare incident with Leslie Kane, a really important one, which is great because it brings awareness and it's an amazing event. But the issue is, just like Chris Mellon was talking about, is where does that information go, though, that we need somebody to take a serious look at this, someone with the resources, you know, to do full research and investigation on these. And even though Elizondo's group exists, it's not funded. Perhaps there's another group in the government we don't know about that is funding research into these areas, but that we need some place for this information to go and to be analyzed so we can figure something out.
You know,
Chris Mellon's article was great. His op-ed in the Washington Post with the third video.
Right, right. Makes me wonder that now that they've sort of uncovered this and it's being talked about, if they are going to do more research, are they going to be more open about it? As far as, you know, the Pentagon themselves, will they be more open about it? Or is it still going to be classified and hard to get any information out of them?
It's a great question. You know, I wrote my piece on the third video just a few days ago, and people can take a look at that. And I did take a little bit of a skeptical look in that, you know, we still have to face that. We have had a couple comments, one given to The Sun. Some people question their credibility, but I know the author, and I don't think she's lying, where she was told by Defense Intelligence, we haven't released any video, and there's confusion about this group. And then more recently, CNET was told by the Department of Defense that we didn't release any files or videos, and I don't know what they're talking about. Of course, this was like an assistant to the deputy, so this was a politician, essentially, not really someone down there like Elizondo, who's got his hands in there actually doing the work. So, and then we have what Elizondo and what the DOD told the New York Times and everything. So there is still some kind of disconnect where the DOD has not really faced this issue or discussed it largely. And they have declined some FOIAs for requesting more information about these cases. So
really,
at least so far, it doesn't seem like they're any more open to sharing information.
Did they actually decline something or just not respond?
They did tell, at least I know, and you know, with Powell, Robert Powell, who you had on the show, who was investigating the Nimitz case, he had some hope after December that, you know, he might be able to get some documentation, but they came back and they said, no, we don't have anything. Whereas he knows they have something. So it becomes this game of, you know, trying to make your request done in the right way to get that information, because they just try to play these games around the semantics of your requests. We know they have something. We know there were many witnesses to that 2004 San Diego event, that Nimitz carrier strike group event. And so there has to be some documentation. We've got more witnesses than we have documents at this point. And so there have to be some documents. But so far, there have been none released. The only thing we have is that video that was leaked years ago, mysteriously, and more recently was, you know, let out by the DOD via the New York Times.
Right. Well, Alejandro, thanks so much.
Yep. Thank you. Have a great time with Dean. I know this is going to probably be a really fun conversation. He's always a lot of fun, and then insightful as well.
Very good. All right. Thanks. I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Okay, everyone, so we have our guest coming up, and Dean Aliotto, he studied film at the University of Southern California and San Francisco State University, and he did this amazing film. We're going to talk about it when he was very young on a very low budget, and it kind of took off, had a life of its own. We're going to be talking about that and a lot more. Dean, welcome to the show. You have to unmute, Dean.
I am now unmuted. first of all, I want to say No one rocks a Denver Broncos t-shirt like Alejandro.
I didn't even notice that. I thought Broncos were orange or something.
But no, there was some orange. It was mostly the blue. He had the blue. He was rocking the blue.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. I'll have to let him know. He's gone now. But anyway, it was a real pleasure meeting you out in Phoenix. Had some good laughs out there. And I was really excited to get you back on the show. I know you were on just for a few minutes out there. But can you tell the listening audience that has no clue of who you are a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I'm a Los Angeles-based filmmaker. Been working in Los Angeles for about the past 20 years. Before that, San Francisco Bay Area. And so I've kind of worked in all genres of shows, even different formats, like from TV, features, online. And there's about a third of the material that I do happens to be UFO and alien based. So I keep coming back to this touchstone, if you will, of aliens and UFOs. So it's something that I always attribute. When I was young and I was a kid, my father, I was on Ritalin as a kid, and I had a lot of energy as a kid. And so we're talking around between 7 and 9. And so I was on about 10 milligrams, and then that wasn't enough. So I was put on 20, then I was put on 30. So finally, it put me into the Walking Dead category. And because of that, during the day, I was kind of like a little bit of a zombie. And then at night, it wears off. And what happens then is you're up all night. Like the Jerry Lewis telethon, I saw the whole thing. I didn't take any naps, no siestas for Dean. And and so what I would do is I would find myself looking out my window at night, looking at the stars. And it was this kind of way for me to, I don't know, look beyond what was going on in my life. You know, what was going on beyond my parents' divorce and everything. And I was living away from my brothers at the time, my older and my younger brother, my older brother Mark and Matt. And so it was a way to kind of look out there and kind of escape and go beyond that. And I kept going to the stars and kept looking at that. And so as a kid, the shows that I really reacted to was anything that was science fiction, because that was the only time you'd really see a star field in a story. And so it just became this thing that started out early and captured my imagination and the idea of wonderment and awe. And so that was kind of, I think, what seeded my imagination as a filmmaker.
And so let's talk about the film you made. And I know your friend came along and he said he'd wanted to be a show producer at $6,500. Is that the right number?
Yeah, because you know you can become a producer in Hollywood for $6,500. What had happened was I had just around the time I'd graduated from film school, or dropped out of film school. Let's be honest. Can we talk full disclosure here?
Yeah, let's just
two film schools, not one but two. I was just too impatient to get things going as a filmmaker.
Were you out of Ritalin?
I was out of Ritalin.
Yeah,
that was the big cause. It was like, now what do I do? Now what do I do? And so what happened was all of my heroes, Steven Spielberg, Orson Welles, you know, Martin Scorsese, all these guys had made their movies by before age 25. And so that number was a few years away and was really freaking out. And so I thought, what can I do? I got to make a movie. And so I had this guy that I'd gone to high school with, and he said, hey, I'll give you, you know, some money. I've got a little bit of some money stashed away. And how much you got? $6,500. And I said, yeah, I think I can do a home video for that. Thanks, but no thanks. So I went along trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do. And then I read the book Communion. And then I took a flight, because I was living in San Francisco at the time, to Los Angeles, where I was going to pitch a story. And as I was leaving, it was one of those flights, as you're on the tarmac, the sun sets, and you see the stars come out. And as I'm flying, you know, as we're taking off, I look out the window and I'm imagining, what if this was me looking at the Earth the last time I was being abducted, and this is me looking away? And for some reason, that thought, mixed with a cocktail of Communion, and all of the other In Search Of TV series and Close Encounters, certainly, and E.T., a big influencer. I came up with the idea of doing a home video, but incorporating those two things. And so when I say home video, this is way before found footage. This is like 10 years before Blair Witch. And so it was just this desperation. So I thought, okay, well, what if I videotape this thing that you would naturally have a videotape, a camera out, videotaping. And so it was this girl's birthday party in a cabin up in the hills. And so, and then there's a blackout and they go out to investigate, and one by one, they get abducted by aliens. So that was the conceit. And we improvised it all. I had a 10-page outline that I worked off of, and we improvised for like 2 weeks, had it pretty well dialed in, went out and shot it in one night. And the ship and the aliens was produced for about $750. The guy who did those, very talented production designer, Bill Bowes, would go on to do the first Fantastic Four film and work with Tim Burton on many of this animation stuff, stop motion stuff he did. And so anyway, we shot this thing, and it was this kind of experimental thing that was more or less just to get me past the hurdle of making my first film. So that was the final goal. That was achieved. And then at that point, we had our screening, which Jacques Vallée attended and through a mutual friend, and enjoyed it. And we had a conversation after, which was pretty funny, because I just wanted to talk to him about aliens, and all he wanted to talk to me about was making movies. So we had to kind of meet in the middle. And so it ended up getting distributed. And so kind of happy ending, except the distribution company burned to the ground. Literally. And so
wait a minute.
It was,
just before you move on, what type of process was it in at the time? I mean, when you say it burned to the ground, did it burn down with some original footage or something?
You know, flames and fire, that's what happened. It literally burned to the ground. I'm not saying that the guy who owned the distribution company set it on fire for insurance reasons. It wouldn't be the first time that happened, but anyway, that was it. So I lost my main master and all my artwork. And I thought, all right, well, that's it. Time to move on. So flash forward a few years later, and I get a call from this guy named Sean David Morton. And Sean is saying that he represents people who are interested in this film. He tells me, he says, do you know anything about this found footage? Which is the first time I'd ever heard this. I think we're talking about maybe 91, 92, around there, maybe 93. He says that, I guess, a few screeners got out to some mom-and-pop video stores before the distribution company burned to the ground. So someone much more clever than I am, edited off the credits and passed it around for community as the real McCoy. So it ended up at the International UFO Congress Convention in, I believe, 93. And supposedly just, brought the house down. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Don Ware claimed it was authentic, and so did a researcher, Tom Dongo. And so hearing all this stuff.
Can we hold here right now?
Yeah.
So you're saying that, let me get this straight. So the distribution company burns to the ground, but they had a few screeners that went out there. Someone actually took that and they removed you from it, removed all the credits.
They cut out the credits. Yeah.
And then they put it out there as a real, like, this is real found footage. And this is still 10 years before Blair Witch or so.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I kind of laugh and I go, well, no one found it. We made it. And he says, all right, well, Unsolved Mysteries is out. And I'm like, dude, who are you? And he says, okay, so here's what's going on. Tells me the whole story. And he says, Unsolved Mysteries was interesting. He said, we might be able to get around that. And I go, well, the mystery is so fast now. He says, okay, we've got hard copy. And we have a show called Encounters for Fox. And so I end up on Fox as the world's greatest UFO hoax. This is before Alien Autopsy or anything. And so I go on and they interview me and everything. And it's still, to me, this kind of amusing thing that the impetus for it was, is that I'd never been abducted by aliens, and or any other whatever species they could be, or future beings, whatever. But I thought, how do I experience that and show it to audiences? So that was the conceit of this. And so so the thing continued circulating, and then the Japanese reached out to me and they wanted some of the footage, and it just became this whole thing. And I thought that was the end of the story. So then about 2 years later, I'm working on the Stephen J. Cannell crime series. And the head writer of the show, Paul Chitlick, says to me, "I heard about this video. I want to see it." And I said, no, it's all handheld. It's really weird, dude. It's handheld. It's like it's this home video. And he's like, "Show it to me." So I finally show it to him. And he watches it and he says, "I dig it. I can get us a TV movie deal with this." And I flippantly said, "Okay, Paul, you can, write the script. I'll have a story by credit and I'll direct it and we'll produce it together." The next day, we had a meeting at Dick Clark Productions. So we went there. We didn't say anything. We just shook Neil Stern's hands, who was the head of the TV division at the time. And we put in the tape from Encounters, the 6-minute tape. He watched it, shook our hands, laughed, and said, "You guys have a deal." That was my first Hollywood deal. So now we go out and we're shopping it to networks and stuff. We go to Fox. And Mike Darnell, who was there, who's the guy who was greenlighting the films for reality TV, passes. He says that people lose careers over this. And then a year later, he ends up doing Alien Autopsy. I don't think anyone lost their career over that, with Bob Kiviat. And then we end up doing it at UPN. And now the budget is $1.25 million. So normally, as a filmmaker, you'd be very excited about that. But I still know that the parameters of what I'm doing is essentially something that's going to be shot in one night, at least a week. So I don't know how to spend that much money. So I'm like, geez, can we get the guys from the X-Files? So we get the guys from the X-Files to do the ship and aliens. And so we go up in Vancouver. And now that $1.25 million is going to come in around $1.7 million. And so kind of more stress is coming. And we end up coming about $500,000 under budget, which is great because wow. My awesome agent had negotiated a deal to get a percentage under, a good incentive for a filmmaker to come in under budget. Mm-hmm. And so we made the thing, and it was great. We shot in a week. We did 5 20-minute takes, and this time it was scripted. The only snafu, really, there were 2 snafus. The first one was that the movie was timing out as, instead of 2 hours, it was timing out as an hour. So what that means is that it'll only play for an hour and it's supposed to be 2 hours. And that's, with the commercial, et cetera, all those breaks. And so we essentially had to write a whole other script. So I came up with a new outline. I handed half the outline to Paul. I wrote the other half, including the confessional where Tommy, the kid who's shooting it, goes into the bathroom and says, he fears for his life and he's going to die, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so the crew were great. I mean, one of them had tickets to the World Series, the cast did, and they decided to stay and put in the time to memorize it all. Wow. And so we're shooting this and we're back on track. Everything's great. And then we get the call. The call is that everyone at UPN has been fired. So I don't know what that means at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm new to all this. And so what happens is we come back and I'm forced to deliver a final cut in 2 weeks' time, which is pretty much unheard of. Oh. So we grind and get the whole thing done, including effects and everything. It's shown at UPN, and the head of UPN watches it, and literally, apparently, someone in his group were throwing food at the screen, said it was the worst piece of crap they'd ever seen. They were going, "What the hell are you guys up to with this network? This is their first TV movie." And they're like, "You did 20-minute takes, no actors, handheld, and you shot it digitally. What the hell is that?" And so all of these firsts that were to come later on were grossly not appreciated. And so I get fired from the project, and they bring in this woman to shoot some more interviews and then infuse those into it and cut the show down to an hour. Unfortunately, the interviews that she got in there, that she integrated into it, were actually real UFO researchers, not the ones that we had that were fictional. So it, again, it diverted from its natural path, which was to be a fictional, you know, movie like War of the Worlds type thing. And so enter Stanton Friedman. He gets interviewed. So does Yvonne Smith and a few other people. And they're juxtaposed against the actual real people and the footage. So it looks like they're commenting on the footage. So when it aired, that was the first time I saw the show as well. So it was mortifying for me because, you know, Stanton Friedman has been one of my idols and, you know, with the whole Roswell breaking and everything, that story. So it was a little bit of a bittersweet thing for me. But, you know, it got me into the Directors Guild and got my first film done. And then they did an online poll to see if people still believed it was real. Half of the audience, and this is the first online poll that I'm aware of that had ever taken place on a show before, half of the audience believed that it was real. Even after seeing credits, Alien 1 played by so-and-so, Alien 2, Alien 3. So I didn't get what that meant. And what it meant is the internet, again, this is like 98. The internet was burgeoning, it was just coming in, and all of a sudden it starts feeding, it starts building, and then it becomes this huge conspiracy. And then they do more and more research, and then the list of conspiracy theories starts building and escalating. And so the three main ones are that it was based on, that the remake was actually based on a real video of an alien abduction. And they cite my original one as being the real one. The second one is that that I work for the government and that I'm part of some disinformation campaign. And the third one is that there is still some video out there separate from mine, a video out there that is actually the real thing that I've, you know, spun into, you know, this whole big, disinformation campaign. So I've, you know, my first reaction was, this is awful. This is horrible. I can't believe this. You know, this is not my intention and I have documentation to prove all that, but that doesn't matter because it's the internet and, you know, fake news rules. And then I kind of rolled with it. It took me a while though, to kind of somewhat embrace it and say, all right, well, this is the, you know, modern mythology. Is it's not built on, you know, from cavemen to cavemen telling a story or this to that. It's now word of net. And so, so the internet carries that. And so, you know, I kind of let this thing lie dormant. And in the meantime, over the years, I've watched the conspiracies build. And then I meet Alejandro and I'm invited to come out to speak at the International UFO Congress Convention for the 25th anniversary of my original UFO abduction. And so I was out there and I got a chance to do your podcast sitting across from Yvonne Smith and Stan Friedman and then Travis Walton and Nick Pope and a whole bunch of other luminaries, Dr. Bob, et cetera. And that was, just fantastic. That was great. It was like the icing on the cake, and got a chance to apologize. And Stan had no memory of ever even doing the movie. So I'd been harboring this fear of, I got to do mea culpa. I have to apologize. And I was like, ah, whatever. So, anyway, yeah. So, oh, and then I heard my favorite conspiracy theory about me, which is, in the 70s, there was a mayor, named Joseph Alioto in San Francisco. And this conspiracy is that that I'm his son. Now, the mayor was a great mayor. He was being groomed for presidency, and then Look magazine, which was not doing too well at the time, came out with a story linking him to the mafia. This is not a conspiracy. They linked him to the mafia, and which he was not connected to, and he proved it because he's a better lawyer than he is a mayor. And he sued Look for magazine for $20 million. And won, which is why there's no longer Look magazine. They went bankrupt. End of story. So I never met the guy. I think my grandparent or my grandfather, my great-grandfather brought a cousin over, and that was the mayor's father or something. But never, no one ever knew if they were first, second, or third. We all came from the same place in Italy. Anyway, there's a lot of Aliotas. So I've never met the guy. He's passed away since then. That was great. So the belief was that the government got to my father, the ex-mayor, who got to me, and I agreed to work with the government to do this. So that was a whole new one that I heard at the convention.
Did you have any actually confrontations with anyone that was? Now, I remember you telling some story about someone was said they knew the people in the film or something.
Yeah, there was. Not at the convention. There was someone who said sent me an email and said, how do you explain the fact that my mother is no longer friends with my mother's best friends is no longer friends with the McPhersons, which is what the remake I did. It was called the McPherson Tape, the original version. And then it became Alien Abduction Incident in Lake County. And I emailed back and I said, I really can't explain how your mother's best friend is no longer friends with fictional characters. But there were a few people that were at the convention that Alejandro said, hey, and this was after I spoke at a panel, is there anyone that still believes that Dean isn't telling the truth and that this might actually be real? And in the back, of course, in the back of the theater, a few people raised their hands. And these were the ones who were willing to raise their hands. And so at the end of it, at the end of the panel, Alejandro held up my movie and said, Dean wants to give whoever still believes it a copy of his movie free of charge. Here it is. This is, yeah. No one would come up and claim it.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. That's a riot. And so the original, is that still floating around somewhere? Like the ones that the people got out, you know, without your credits or anything, is that still out there, or do you remove it from YouTube? How do you take care of like the
IP
trademark?
Keep her my IP. Yeah. So what happens is once a month I go online. The YouTube copyright infringement and I have become real good buds, and I shut them down for two reasons. One is I own this and. It's my IP and hold the copyright. The second is that they're showing really, really crappy versions of it. So that's not great. No filmmaker wants that.
Fifth generation or something, you mean?
Yeah, with you know, static across the screen at some of the key points and everything. And some of that lends to the credibility, I guess. But it's just they're missing some of the nuances and stuff. And like you see the alien outside the window and that you don't see with that. So for when Alejandro, when we talked about me coming out there, I decided to go back to my originals. So even though the master was destroyed, the actual tapes that was recorded on was not. And so what I actually did is I went online and I found a bootleg copy of my movie, and I used that to mark where the cuts were, and had gone back to my original footage, which was shot on 8mm stereo. It was the first stereo camera for 8mm video. And I remastered it, digitally remastered it. And I up-resed it and created a whole new master for it. And then I put in the encounters segment, Fox Encounters, behind the scenes segment of it, merited to it. And so now, I am selling, the actual movie for downloads and DVDs and everything. So it is now, for the first time ever, available. One funny thing is that there have been people over the years who sent me money wanting copies of the film. And I sent out a couple, and then I had lost several, like half a dozen. And I, when I went into storage and I was digging out to get all the tapes and everything, I found the 15 that I did not send out. And I found all these, and I spent about a week tracking them down. And I was able to reach maybe a third, almost half of them. And I reached out and called these guys through LinkedIn or Facebook and freaked them out. There was a lot of acid flashbacks for these guys because, you know, some of them were varying ages and stuff. And I reached out to them. I'm like, oh, my God, dude, you have no idea how much it's affected my childhood. I still sleep with the lights on and everything else, and which I apologize for. And so anyway, I ended up sending them out the videos, you know, 15 years later, so, or 20 years later.
Not exactly overnight. Wow.
No, it's not UPS or FedEx for sure.
So I watched the version, the UPN version, after they brought in, you know, Stanton Friedman, Daryl Sims, Yvonne Smith, a few others. I got to tell you, it was really good. I really thought it was very well done. Not including the actual, when they come in, I'm talking about the real experts. Not talking about that, but did you do all the filming prior to that? You know, the McPherson tape, so to speak?
Yeah, all the footage. My original footage, especially in the two-hour version, it's everything that happens with all that's my footage. And then there's some interstitial interviews. In fact, in the foreign version, I play this this filmmaker, and I say that there's no way this is fake because, if it was, I would have been the one to have made it. And that was a funny little nod that we put in there, kind of an Easter egg, so to speak, in the international version. So the domestic version cut out some of those, including me, and they put in the new ones. And then they also had this woman who was going around as if she was a reporter tracking this case. And so that stuff I had zero to do with. In fact, the woman who came in to do that tried to get our credits removed. And so the DGA, this is what they do, and same with the WGA. So they went after them, and that was quickly nipped in the bud. And she got a credit that says additional interviews by. So what you saw was all my footage except for, Stanton and a couple of other people interviews, and that's it. So
well, I got to tell you, I can totally get where someone, if they stumbled across that or walked in the middle of it. They could actually, that's actually believable. I mean, it's really well done. The actors are extremely believable. And, overall, I thought there were some really good twists and turns. For instance, when the fuse box is melting and the battery in the car is melting and all those type of things, things that people have, they haven't really talked about those type of things, but they have talked about, electromagnetic interference when, some encounters happen and stuff like that. But anyway, I thought it was very convincing. And I can actually see why people are, questioning whether it's real or not.
That's a huge compliment to the cast and crew. I mean, these guys really work their asses off. What we had done for rehearsal is I got a warehouse and then taped off the actual measurements of the house we're going to be shooting at. And so the hardest thing for these actors were to do is you look at it and you go, oh, well, they're just, a lot of people just think, oh, they're just improvising. And the first one, certainly we did that. And the second one, there was no improvising. It was all written out. The toughest part for the actors was to turn their back to the camera. No actor ever wants to do that. So I would say this scene, all of you guys, your back is to the camera. The camera will find you. And so so that was a challenge for them. And also, when we were doing casting, there were a couple actors that could not swear. We're shooting in Canada. I guess it's not something that they were known for, at least in the 90s. This one actor, it was very, very funny. I kept saying, can I swear on this, by the way?
No.
We'll say the F word. We'll just say the F word. He couldn't say the F word. He kept saying friggin'. And when he was supposed to say the SH word, he would go shoot. And so, anyway, it was humorous, but the cast really brought it. The crew was fantastic, top notch. They were pulling out all the stops for it. So I felt like we were, taken care of. Everyone got on board with it because we all knew that we were doing something special. That was the one thing that got us through some of the long nights. Again, this is a TV movie all shot in a week, which had never been done before. So they had to be on their A game. And I got to say, the crew up in Vancouver rocked the hell out of it.
Wow. So no wonder you came in under budget.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say stuff to the effects guys, like I would say, can we see the smoke coming out when those the fuse box, like you mentioned in the engine, they blow out, can we see that? Yeah, we can do that. And we can time it. So when it happens, we do that. And so just so you can see the mechanics behind how we shot this, We had a cameraman who we hired. In the original version, UFO Abduction, I was the cameraman and played the kid. And in the remake, we hired specifically a DP. And so the DP is on a headset with me. So I'm looking at one monitor, and I'm sequestered away in this room that you don't see. And I'm telling the camera, pan right, pan left. And then I've got another headset here. And that one, I'm cueing the crew, the first AD, Gareth, great guy. I'm cueing him to cue the effects and cue all the stuff. And we have an actor who's playing the kid who has to navigate around. So whenever the cameraman, you know, like sets the camera down so that we can have the actor who's playing him, Tommy, comes out, he sets it down, and they're dressed the same. So sometimes the cameraman will look down at his shoes because he's dressed exactly like the kid, a grown man. And so it was a bit of a juggling act. And at some point, I will say, I think by Friday or by Thursday, the cameraman got into the zone, as they say. And there wasn't too much direction I gave him. We had rehearsed it, but he just went off and he was in it and part of the panic and everything. And so we were all kind of into this experimental thing. And
wow.
I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
You had to do a little voiceover in situations like that. As far as the kid's voice with the camera running along with the camera, that's...
Yeah, well, he was right there. For the one-hour version, to link some of the things that they did, because they did cut it down, they brought in a sound-alike who sounded, I didn't think, very much like him. So that was a few places in the one-hour version that bridged that. But the kid playing Tommy, the guy playing Tommy, he had to be right next to the cameraman. Like literally was holding his belt behind him. And so he was giving him all the lines, feeding it.
I got it. Before I want to move on, but before I move on, I want to invite people to call in if they have any questions about this film or questions actually for the guest. The call-in number is up on YouTube. If you'd like to call in, feel free. Also, we have some of that's monitoring the chat if you'd rather just post a question on chat about this film before we move on to other topics. Go ahead. And so I'll just keep on this subject just for a little bit longer and then we'll move on. So as far as what do you think will happen? Will you think this will continue getting out there and people, you know, making up conspiracies about it?
Boy, in today's day and age, it can only build. So, I mean, just going to the convention alone, I heard, you know, like I said, a few more theories. You know, you type in my name in alien or UFO abduction, and it goes on for hundreds of pages. There's a part of me that's kind of frightened because of how it's affected politics today. The fact that people are unable to discern what's real and what isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, when you and I grew up, there were three networks, not counting UHF. And so you'd get your news from, Dan Rather or Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw. And that was it. And you would just tune in and you'd get that and you took their word. That was it. Now conglomerates own, as you know, many news organizations. So the agenda is pushed wherever they want it to go. So the news slants one way or the other. And it becomes a big vacuum. And, you know, there's a lot of people on Facebook who have cleared out and gotten rid of all the people who are on one side or not on their side. And so the problem with that is then you just have this echo chamber. And so, you know, I think I might be going off topic here, but I think that there's kind of a bigger picture of where this is going. And I think that you can, just like you can pick your own movies, you can pick your own truth. And so I think that you know, the fact that UFOs and aliens are so prevalent and they're the second most Googled, searched item on the internet, second only to porn, shows that it's a pretty huge part of the general public's interest. And so I think it's going to continue. And you know, I have a few more projects that I'm considering working on in this space and in development on. So, you know, not to continue propagating more, you know, anything that's an intentional hoax at all, but to work in a world where, in a film space where I'm able to show what it looks like and what it is for people who have not had that experience, only because I want to see what that experience is like, you know, meeting beings from another planet or from the future or another dimension, whatever it is.
So can you talk about some of your proposed projects coming up? I saw on your Patreon page that you have some ideas. Are you anything in the works, or just is it in a thought process at this point?
Well, I'd love to tell you, but the government has made me sign a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't really get into it. What I can tell you is that if you go to patreon.com, I think it's .com/alien content, and there'll be a link, I'm sure, on your site to this. You can see the three projects that I'm in development on right now. What I've done is basically, because I keep going back and coming back to this genre, I decided to focus on that. And so for the near future here, I'm in the UFO and alien extraterrestrial business, and the three projects I have. The first is a kind of combination of All the President's Men meets Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So basically what that means is it's about a young reporter who teams up with a young blogger to unearth the world's greatest UFO cover-up. And it's a mystery thriller, really fun project. Because I also write, direct, edit, and shoot my own stuff and even color grade a lot of my own stuff. And I'm working independent. I'm not working as a hired gun. I can do these things for a decent amount of money, but we still need budgets for these things. But we're able to do these things and do them in a way that are because I don't have any outside person influencing me. I don't have studios or networks or anything else. I'm able to do these things based on as much real evidence that I've been able to, you know, evidence that seems to resonate with the truth, and incorporate that into these. So that's the first one. That's called Dark Side of the Moon. That's a really fun project. All of my projects have a little bit of humor in them, by the way, because I'm a card-carrying smartass, so there's nothing I can do about that. So that's the first one. And then the second one is a third remake of my Alien Abduction movie. And so there's a lot of things that are kind of, the conspiracy is built so much that, and I have grown as a filmmaker. And so there's a lot of things I love to go back and explore. Because I find that every single movie I make, there's one theme that's throughout, and that is family. Family is really, really important to me. And I tend to do movies that deal with family that have dealt with tragedy or breaking, you know, up the fracturing of a family, our family coming together. And so even though it's in a specific genre, to me, that's the core. That's the experience of the human, you know, condition. So so that one, there's a lot more room in it now, you know, 20 years later, 25 years later, for me to swim in. There's some great twists and turns that I'd like to add that I, you know, would like to see myself. And that's called Incident Lake County. And then the third project I'm doing is based on a novel that I wrote, which is called Skyler's Alien Abduction Blog. And this is one of my favorite projects. It's about a young kid who moves out from San Francisco to Los Angeles to make it in the indie rock scene as a drummer. And so he gets success pretty early on, within the first 6 months, gets hooked up with a band. The band is about to blow up, and he dates this groupie who unfortunately gets abducted occasionally by extraterrestrials. And so she has him over one night when she knows that they're going to be there. And now he gets abducted, and it just spirals his world to the point he's having flashbacks. He can't function. He gets kicked out of the band. And so the series is, that's like the opening. And the series is, here's this guy trying to function, trying to rebuild his career as a, you know, young millennial, working at Starbucks while at night booby trapping his house from extraterrestrials. And so he keeps this blog going because his therapist, who doesn't believe him, recommended it to keep his sanity. So he's got this anonymous blog called Skyler's Alien Abduction Blog. And that's a TV series project that I'm doing. It's a half hour show.
Wow, that sounds really good, actually. So, yeah, you know, I've actually had contemplated, like, people that, you know, claim they are getting abducted, like, on a regular basis. I can't even imagine how someone could, if something like that is happening, whether it can be explained or not, I can't understand how someone can even function in the world. You know, I mean, it must be, it just seems like it would be pure hell to go through.
Dude, I can't function on 2 cups of coffee.
And Ritalin. So, yeah.
And Ritalin. yeah, I get 2 cups and I'm getting really jiggy. Just one is enough for me.
Well, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. And occasionally, as you've noticed, I put in some full 2-hour shows in the free section so you get an idea of what they are like. If you can't support our show for only $2 or more a month, you can always listen to the full shows either live at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Wednesday, or you can check them out on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Also, that is Thursdays from 10 to midnight. Our guest, as I mentioned earlier, is Robert Schroeder. He'll be on next week. Should be an interesting show. I want to thank some people that help us out. First of all, our guest, Dean Aliotto, also Alejandro Rojas. I want to thank Peggy for helping with the Facebook page, as well as Evan for helping behind the scenes. And I also want to thank my internet for finally working right. So we'll be back next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.